Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Had it not been for a couple of weeks ago, whenever we had a cool front that came to the area, and I mean, in that, in generosity, a cool front being less than 90 degrees, we would have set another record for the most consecutive days of 100 degrees over the record. So that's had a very detrimental impact to the crop.
Cody Besson is CEO of Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers.
While producers are very astute as far as their agronomic practices and trying to utilize as much water efficiency as they can as far as irrigation capacity and then capturing rainfall that they have, it's just hard to keep up with Mother Nature whenever they're throwing these kinds of things our way from a heat standpoint. So we're still optimistic about the fact that this year will be better than last year. We are very confident about that, but it's still a very big challenging year overall.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Finally, the administration has stepped up. They've been silent for too long.
Don Bacon represents the 2nd Congressional District of Nebraska, is a member of the House Ag Committee.
We have a trade deal with Mexico. All the stuff's already been worked out. And for them to now come in and say they're not going to take our GMO corn is a violation of the agreement we have with USMCA. And we expect our administration to speak up and defend our farmers. They have, a little late to the table, but we need them to be forceful with Mexico on this. We have an agreement. They should live up to it. And there's nothing wrong with our GMO corn. In fact, that's why we're leading the world in production and yield. This stuff has, you know, been carefully looked at by our scientists, and they're there to increase yield, protect our crops, and that's why we have it.
But the latest move by the administration is gathering applause from the American Seed Trade Association.
Well, we just this last month, the Biden administration and the U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai announced that they were filing a formal complaint against the Mexican government on the policy with respect to their blocking imports or intention to block imports of white corn and corn to Mexico that is produced through GMO GMO traits.
Andy Levine is CEO of the American Sea Trade Association, or ASTA.
You know, it's something that we've worked with the Mexican government over the last 2 years, and some of their first concerns were raised. Really a populist move by the president of Mexico, and one that is not good, obviously, for America's farmers, corn farmers, soybean farmers, others who are using biotech products, but also the Mexican farmers, the Mexican livestock producers, and the Mexican economy. So we really see it as a, you know, quite a populist move, but one that is right with respect to science and regulation. And as we always like to say, science-based regulation, unlike ones that are more, you got to prove 100% that it's safe. So we're really looking forward to this process moving forward.
Now, while it's only geared towards white corn, it is somewhat of a Pandora's box. If you can block this, what else can be blocked?
You have to look at it as when you're sending product to another country, oftentimes, most of the times, you're sending it in a processed form already. It's been milled, or it's been put into oil or some other form of that raw material. And so distinguishing between what's white or number two corn, it's not a very good possibility in the marketplace to start with. And then you start to look at other countries that will say, well, if Mexico's doing that, we're going to do it. And realistically, Tony, when you look at this, it's 90-something percent of the corn in the U.S. is biotech, 90% or better in Argentina and in Brazil is biotechnology. Same with soybeans. Where are you going to get the conventional corn? Mexico's corn growers are already pretty maxed out from what we understand from the acreage they have. The U.S. isn't going to easily convert back to using growing conventional because of the impact on the environment, more passes through the field. So many other factors come into play. And the fact that today you just can't turn that switch on and automatically produce conventional corn seed. So there's so many factors that come into play that make this completely unrealistic.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Told my ag legislative assistant, I basically said, look, I got bad news, I got good news.
Representing the 19th Congressional District of California, Jimmy Panetta.
Bad news is I'm not on the Ag Committee. The good news is I have relationships, good, solid relationships, with Republican members on the Ag Committee, and that's how we're going to be able to work our stuff in and represent our constituents in the 19th Congressional District. And that's exactly what we're doing. Look, I'm still on Ways and Means, therefore trade. I'm still protecting our trade there through committee and make sure that our producers have the benefit of me being on such an important committee. But at the same time, like I said, this is a place about relationships. You know that, Tony, based on the members you've talked to. And let me tell you, those that represent agriculture districts, it's really easy. One, sure, we could come back here and point out our differences, okay? Most of my Republican colleagues on the Ag Committee that have ag districts are from pretty red districts. I'm from a pretty blue district. It's easy for us to point out our differences. But what I love is that we work to find our similarities, especially when it comes to common ground and focusing on what type of crops and what type of benefits and what type of funding we can provide for our producers. And let me tell you, if there is a bipartisan committee, look, we're going to see our fights coming up in the Farm Bill when it comes to the conservation and SNAP. We get that. But you got to look at the bigger picture. And for the most part, it's a pretty bipartisan bill. And that's why it pains me that I wasn't on the Ag Committee as I was for my past three terms. But I'll be back on. And even if I'm not on, like I said, my relationships give me the foundation to make sure that I get in my priorities for my constituents in the 19th Congressional.
He says when it comes to ag, especially in California, the future of mechanization is vital.
Yeah, look, it always has been. Obviously, getting into this job, knowing that I was going to be the representative for specialty crop producers, and realizing early on, well before I got into this office, but growing up on the Central Coast in that agriculture community, that what it takes to harvest those types of crops. And unfortunately, the mechanization and the machines haven't caught up to the necessary human discernment that's needed to basically, for example, see a strawberry plant, pick a ripe, aesthetically pleasing strawberry, and then pack it in one of those clamshells. And right now, human discernment is tough to match. But heck, man, we got Silicon Valley right above the Salinas Valley. We need to start relying on the technology that's available and investing in that. And that's where the federal government should come up and start to ensure that the funding's there for our producers to invest in the type of technology that's needed. That's why I introduced two bills that we're going to be getting into this Farm Bill. The Precise Act, which basically says that if you start to invest in mechanization, you can then have that covered through certain conservation programs. Because what you got to realize is a lot of this drip irrigation goes to, you know, obviously conservation. And so why not put those in the conservation programs? And so we're willing to do that as well. And then you also have the Precision Act, which basically provides low interest loans for the pivot to mechanization as well. Let's be clear. Labor is important. We understand that. Our farm workers are part of the backbone of our agricultural industry, especially there in California. However, you're seeing that workforce shrink. You're seeing it age, and it's just not there. That's why we need to make sure that we replace not the labor. We replace the lack of labor that our farmers have experienced all too often coming up here. And so being able to invest, making sure the federal government steps up and helps our producers invest in mechanization through the Precise Act and the Precision Act is something that I look forward to continuing to push forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One of the things that I think is been highly overlooked is the digestibility of the fiber portion that we're putting into those animals.
Mark Kirk is a forage specialist with Alta Seeds.
We know that in feeding cattle and especially finishing cattle, a high percentage of that is concentrate. It's you know, a high percentage of that is starch from corn grain. But in order to make that rumen function properly, we've got to get some fiber in them and some digestible fiber. And one of the things is we've typically wanted to limit the amount of fiber that we put in there because we don't want to fill them up. So, because it takes longer to break the fiber portion down than it does to take, than it does to break the starch down. I mean, you know, in four, five, 6 hours, all of the starch that has been ingested by a feeder cattle has pretty much either been absorbed or passed through. And so they're sitting there and starch is not the limiting factor for those. It's how much fiber we can put in there without really ruining their digestive system. And so when we think about that, we don't want to put too much in because we don't want them to fill up and we want them to continue to eat. One of the things that good quality sorghum silage, good quality sorghum can bring you is digestible fiber that is highly digestible. And not only that, but fiber that has a low UNDF 240 number. Now, some guys kind of, you know, dairy nutritionists understand the UNDF 240 and they kind of understand that. A lot of times beef cattle guys, they're stuck on some of the older numbers, which is not bad. You know, we got total digestible nutrients, TDN, the amount of protein. But one of the things that they have not looked at is the amount of that undigestible fiber fraction within the fiber portion that they're feeding them. And if I can decrease that and still feed the same amount of pounds of fiber and decrease the undigestible portion of that fiber, that cow is going to be able to eat more. And what we know is that they're going to eat about 0.5% of their body weight in undigestible fiber, and then they're going to shut down. And so we're going to be able to put a little bit more fiber in there. They're going to have a little bit healthier rumen. They're going to be able to convert the starches a little bit easier, the fiber a little bit easier, and we're going to be able to increase average daily gains because of that. One of the studies that was done several years ago, I think it was done about 2003, is that they were grazing some stalker calves on sorghum, conventional sorghum, and BMR sorghum, BMR 6 sorghum, and what they found is that they were increasing the pounds of gain per acre by about 38 pounds an animal and the time that they were grazing them. In fact, they were increasing the average daily gain by almost half a pound just by grazing this BMR 6. And so for feeder cattle and for finishing cattle, guys really need to look at this just as a way to be able to push that digestibility.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think there are two things to kind of keep in mind.
Cody Besson is CEO of Plains Cotton Growers. As we near the expiration of the Farm Bill.
One is we've got to keep the government functioning. That's their biggest charge right now, is to make sure that they don't have a government shutdown. And that has all kinds of implications if they do. So, you know, by example, the local county FSA offices that we solely rely upon for certification or for program implementations. If they don't fund the government, then that curtails them. So that's the first and foremost portion they're looking at. As far as the Farm Bill goes, we certainly are seeing a unique depiction of how we go into the development of the 2024 Farm Bill. So the current Farm Bill expires at the end of September. We know that. We certainly want that process to continue to elevate itself and to continue to be ongoing. And they are having those conversations between the four principals of how they develop a robust Farm Bill before the end of the year. But unfortunately, time is of the essence. And so more than likely that will get punted into the end of the year from the development of a new Farm Bill process. And that's something that we are continuing to be mindful of and advocating for, at least our priorities going forward within that process. Now, once we get beyond the calendar year, that's when things start to get a little bit more tricky, I guess. There are a couple of programs that continue on without reauthorization within the current Farm Bill process, and there's a couple of programs that don't, that impact our grower operations as well as others. And so we're trying to keep Congress moving in the right direction to make sure that everything is done in a timely manner So that way we don't have any lapse or any program challenges that had a hiccup or a problem with producer operations or even entities like government entities that implement those operations as well. So.
But a couple of proposals, one that many groups are behind and another that many groups are split on.
Yeah, so as far as cotton and probably relatively overall on most industry fronts, we're certainly looking to develop ways that we can improve the safety net as a whole for all commodities, and that would be an improvement to reference prices. That would be an improvement to the marketing assistance loan. That would be an improvement to crop insurance programs to try to mitigate some of the disaster-related assistance that we've seen overall. You hear a pretty conglomerate message across all commodities. Now, there are some challenges, as you mentioned. One group saying that they want to look at base. You know, base is kind of a unique topic. It's very unique even within finite regions. Our thought process on base is let's hone it up. Let's make sure that folks that are growing the crop that need the assistance have the capability of that assistance through a base program. Excuse me. But not take away from a historical base perspective. So if you do a voluntary base update, that's fine. If you want to try to figure out some unique other mechanisms to adjust base, that's great. But the way the program is in place today, we are very supportive of that. We certainly want to keep that in place, but we also want to make sure that those that aren't encompassed in that program today are brought into that fold, I guess that's the way to put it.
That's Cody Besant, CEO, Plains Cotton Growers. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There are a lot of things going on at the Bureau of Land Management right now, but there are a few key things, I think, that really have been top of mind.
Caitlin Glover, Executive Director, Public Lands Council.
For the last year or so, we've been talking about how the agency is going to revise grazing regulations. So again, talking about that access, the access to forage, and the rules that govern grazing on federal lands. Then we talk about things like lesser prairie chicken and Gunnison sage grouse and greater sage grouse and all of the other species that you manage with and around with grazing. But really what we've been watching for about the last 2 months is a new proposed rule. The BLM sort of out of nowhere published this proposed rule, didn't really give anybody any heads up. There certainly was no advanced discussion about contents, which is quite unusual for a rule of this nature. And what it does is it changes the way the BLM would manage these hundreds of millions of acres across the West. It's really concerning for cattle and sheep producers and anybody who's in that other multiple use scenario, mining, forestry, any other energy development, but also the hikers, the bikers, the mountain bikers and the trail runners, right? Anybody who recreates, hunters and fishers, fishermen. And so it's all of that combined into one proposed rule that when you don't have that advanced discussion, it's kind of concerning. So we've been watching that very closely. We've been leading engagement for the grazing industry as well as coordinating other multiple use groups because there are some parts of this rule that are pretty concerning for what the future looks like.
But why do these matter to those who are not directly affected by public lands?
There's a reason that national organizations like NCBA or the American Sheep Industry Association, even America Outdoors or the Partnerships of Rangeland Trusts, there's a reason these national groups are so concerned about this proposed rule. And it really centers for the grazing industry in one simple or two simple issues, right? You think about what grass or what hay, what forage feeds these animals, and you think about where that forage is concentrated. When we're in a drought year like we were last year, hay prices go through the roof. And so to replace that lost forage that you find on 155 million acres across the West for BLM landscape, it'd be a heck of a lot of hay, right? And so you think about loss of access to forage, the cost or the ability to replace that forage lost. Really what you're talking about is not a replacement of forage, but a condensing of that Western herd. You have a contraction, any sort of herd contraction across the West, that has massive ripple effects across the country. You think about where a lot of cow-calf operations are, especially at scale, They're in the West, and so that has knock-on effects all the way through the supply chain. But there's one other thing, too, and we typically talk about it with the Endangered Species Act, ESA, you know, how the federal government touches or is impacting individual producers or individual production operations. And that's really that what happens in the West, what happens on these federal lands, is often the harbinger of what's to come for private lands as well. The federal government, bless them, they continue to try to have an expanded federal nexus. Their entire goal is to continue pushing boundaries. And so if they get away, if they are successful in having these kind of big, sweeping changes, and they're not checked either by Congress or by stakeholders, they're emboldened. And so then we see more regulatory creep coming. It doesn't matter whether you're a producer in Washington or Nevada or Texas or Louisiana or even Virginia. I usually say that, you know, if it's come to a federal landscape, it's coming to private lands near you.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So one of the other things that, you know, we talk about half the water or a quarter of the water.
Mark Kirk is a forage specialist with Alta Seeds on some additional advantages to sorghum silage over corn.
The other idea is that we've got half of the input costs, half of the nitrogen that we need to grow a bumper corn crop, half of the potassium, half of the phosphorus. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that not only does that save the producer input costs to be able to get the same amount of tons out of my forage sorghum with higher digestibility than most corn silage, not only can I get that cheaper, but you know, there's a lot of talk in a lot of places where we're talking about how the amount of fertilization we put on the ground is also being limited. We talk, you know, water's being limited, how much we can put on, but also the amount of fertilization of manure and other fertilizers being able to put on, and the fact that sorghum can only needs about half of what a corn crop needs, so there's less that's needed there, so it's cheaper, and you know, even though a lot of times, you know, it's just more economic. It's more economically viable, but also more environmentally viable. That I think we're going to see in the future. That guys are going to need to pay a little bit more attention to. And the other point that I'll bring out is over corn silage is seed cost per acre. Tony, you know, sorghum is, you know, $18-$25 an acre. To plant, good corn silage, you know, you're looking at $90 to $100 an acre in seed costs. So, you know, we're drastically reducing seed costs. We're drastically reducing the amount of water needed to produce enough feed to feed cows all year, and also drastically reducing the amount of fertilization and the fertilization costs.
Part of the challenge is overcoming misconceptions.
You know, guys have thought for a long time, oh, I've got to grow corn silage. I know how to grow corn silage. It's easy. Da, da, da. Oh, and the one of the biggest ones that I hear, probably as a kind of negative towards sorghum is, oh, we grew that stuff. It was 12, 15 feet tall. It fell down. We couldn't get it up. Well, we've kind of eliminated that for guys. This big, tall, gangly forage sorghum that just falls over when the seed head gets on and it gets a little over mature. We've been able to mitigate that for guys by being able to breed Bracritic dwarfs. And basically what we do is we take that plant and we just kind of take that plant and just shove it down and shrink it where we have less space between the leaves, between the growth nodes. We have more leaf to stem ratio. All right. And we shorten that plant up. We've also got that stalk a little larger, or that stalk diameter is a little bit bigger. And basically, it stands even through those times where way in the past, what we would call, you know, your grandfather's forage sorghum, it'll stand where that stuff wouldn't. So guys don't have a problem with lodging like they did in the past. And that's one of the biggest ones that I hear is like, oh, I want to grow corn silage because I'm afraid of that stuff falling down. We've eliminated that with Bracritic dwarfs.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The most well-known aspect of the USDA's fertilizer initiative includes, of course, increasing the production capacity of current U.S. fertilizer plants and building new ones.
So we are no longer going to be as connected to Russian and Belarus fertilizer.
But Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told the Farm Progress Show in Decatur, Illinois, Wednesday that along with simply boosting U.S. production of fertilizer,
we're learning more about how to more effectively and efficiently use fertilizer. There is some indication that maybe as much as 30% of our corn acres don't even have to be fertilized at all. As we equip farmers with the information, sensor technology and alike, to be able to know precisely how to use and where to use fertilizer, we can bring costs down.
And he says farm profits up, particularly for small and mid-sized producers who Vilsack says will also benefit from the rapid development of a bio-based climate smart ag economy.
It has never been a better time to be in agriculture.
Gary Crawford, Washington.